The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
And welcome to the College Football Podcast with Herb Street, Pollock, and Negandhi. Great to have David Pollock join us here. Coming up later on the episode.
Herb Street, Pollock, and who?
And this handsome man, Kevin Negandhi.
Oh, I hear you. Well, the only one that actually shows up for the podcast consistently finally has his rightful place and has their name on the podcast.
It's nice to be there as part of the cartoon that we've got the name there. So we do appreciate everybody following us here. And of course, this fall, more Herbie with us, more Pollock. And of course, you can't escape me. Plenty of Negandhi each and every week on the College Football Podcast. On this episode, we've got Texas head coach Tom Herman. He's going to join us in a matter of minutes, as well as Heather Dinich with the very latest around college football and the idea of a schedule maybe being pushed back, but football in the fall. We'll ask Heather about some recent comments she's discussed with the Jack Swarbrick of Notre Dame. But before we get to Tom Herman, Pollock, I saw you on TV last night, and we're taping this in the middle of the week, but you were on ESPN2 with the state of college football, the state of the schedule, with Reese Davis as well as Greg McElroy and Joey Galloway. And you brought up an interesting topic when we were talking about spring football, at least Reese was, and you suggested this concept where we're seeing, you know, the Ivies as well as a couple of other conferences push back the idea of the SWAC, saying we're going to play potentially in spring football, no fall. You put this idea out there, the FCS and what was it, potentially all the other Division II, Division III programs playing football permanently in the spring. Is that accurate? You said you wanted to see how that would play out?
Yeah, why not? You know, we don't not watch that football, Kevin, because it's not good football. It's great football. And, you know, come playoff time, you get dialed in because it's during the bowl season, and usually you find there's not a lot on. And we're watching, we're like, man, this is awesome daggum football. And I just think that if you moved it to the spring without the distractions of Power Five football and all the teams that have the followings and the big followings, I think it will gain a lot of traction. I think people would watch it. You know what else? I think TV, ESPN would pay for agreements, TV deals. I think the teams could make money off of that. I think Hulu, who jumps into, you know, TV, has jumped into TV, YouTube TV, that kind of stuff. I think those people would be takers and buyers in looking for stuff and more content in the spring that people could watch and follow. And I think it could be really a home run. I think it could be awesome for the FCS and the other programs. And I think it could be a win for us. We saw the XFL, Kevin. It was killing it. We loved it. We loved having some football. And I think it would really put those kids on a platform that they don't have. And I think because of TV deals and sponsorships and stuff like that, I think financially they could gain and get to a place where they haven't been and have a win-win for everybody.
I appreciate you saying that, putting them on kind of like the highlighted showcase, especially, you know, when we see the success of North Dakota State and James Madison, and when we get the chance to highlight those programs, right, that don't get the love, and game day goes there and we see it. But I would play devil's advocate on two scenarios. For example, like a guy like Trey Lance, who's playing at North Dakota State, the idea of playing in the spring when he can't get ready for, you know, the combine as well as all the stuff that builds up into the draft. I'm not saying that every year we're going to see a guy who's going to be a first round pick from that level. I'm just saying in this specific case, that could get in the way. And then there's another thing. We love college football. One of the things I think that separates college football from the NFL is tradition, right? The tradition of Saturdays. And no matter what, everybody has a great college football memory, if you're a college football fan, about playing in the fall. The tradition suddenly gets out of whack, right? If you're in the Ivy and you have this tradition of playing, you know, in the fall and leading up to Thanksgiving and that whole vibe and that experience and the seasonal change. What do you say to that when I bring that up to you?
Well, first of all, you know, you're talking about an anomaly at a quarterback spot for North Dakota that I don't disagree with. But
fair point. Yeah.
99.99% of people are not worried about their NFL draft stock in those leagues. And that's why it would never work with moving to spring ball now, because people would be worried about their draft stock and where would they be drafted? When would they be drafted? How would that affect the playing time? Listen, tradition is awesome. I love tradition. We have a lot of traditions and we've seen a lot of traditions, but conferences that people that like, let's see, Nebraska that jump ship and aren't in a conference anymore, that we used to love the rivalries that it created, but financially it benefited Nebraska to leave the conference. So they left the conference and financially they're in a better spot. And because of that, new traditions are built and new traditions are formed. I get it, man. But here's the thing. It could be something where there's so many more new traditions created. There's so much more cash in your pocket. There's so many more things that those universities will be able to do. So much more exposure, so much more some positive stuff, I think, that could really happen for your school. Yeah, I 100% get tradition, but tradition goes by the wayside every year when we expand and when we do our different things because of TV deals and because of money. So I think, you know, that's part of the tradition now of what college football has become.
What I like about the suggestion is the outside the box thinking, right? I'm all for the outside the box thinking. I still, as a Northeast guy, now college football is not as prevalent in the Northeast in certain areas as it would be in the South or the Midwest, or you know, when you look at, for example, Texas, right? But there's just there's a charm when you look at the Northeast playing football, whether these guys are going to be Sunday athletes or not. There's a charm of that football experience in the fall with the leaves around, and you get to go, you know, tailgate and go to a game. I just come
no
back
doubt,
to that.
But it'd be a lot more charming if people watched and people got to see those guys being showcased and not being buried underneath the TV screens, which they get. That's what happens to them in the fall. We don't want
I'm fascinated. And you know, we may have that experiment, right? We may possibly see that experiment this upcoming year, right? Where we have fall football and then we'll have spring football. And to me, it's a fascinating thing. And when you're living in a pandemic, why not try everything right now and see what sticks and figure it out? Don't go by the norms, because all the norms have been thrown out the window, especially in 2020. Good topic, though. Pollock bringing some heat here. I appreciate that.
If we're putting the Gandhi on the podcast now, anything can happen.
Exactly. It's 2020. Literally anything can happen now. Tom Herman coming your way next. And Texas head coach Tom Herman joins us here on the College Football Podcast. Tom, first off, let's just talk about your health. We heard that you had shoulder surgery just a few weeks ago because of your all-conference days at Cal Lutheran as a wide receiver. How are you feeling?
I'm okay. I was actually this past Thursday, so I'm doing good, guy. I've had 15 knee surgeries and 5 now shoulder surgeries, so being a Division III athlete, I think God tried to get me to hang up the cleats a number of different times, and I ignored him as a young guy, and as a middle-aged guy. Now I'm paying the price for it. So no, it was just a clean out. Had some loose bodies and some you know, torn cartilage in there that needed to be kind of scraped away. But I'm feeling okay. Thanks for asking.
That's good to hear. And by the way, let's bring up a little bit of a Cal Lutheran, because, you know, doing a little research here, that's what we try to do. Your roommate in college was current Baylor Bears head coach Dave Aranda. Who would have thought Cal Lutheran would produce 2 Big 12 head coaches? What were those days like for you?
20% of the head coaches in the Big 12 are Cal Lutheran grads. Small Division III school. When we went there, I think it had 1,500. Undergraduate students. My high school was bigger than my college, but yeah, it's been really cool. We've got a lot of Cal Lu connections throughout college football, even professional football. There's a few NFL coaches that are Cal Lu guys. Obviously, you know, Coach Patterson, Gary Patterson, in our own league, he spent a couple years coaching there. So I think that story's been blown a little bit out of proportion. I don't ever remember Dave and I being true roommates. Now, we might have slept on each other's couch from time to time. I don't know if that makes us roommates or not, but you know, we've probably crashed on each other at each other's places before. But now Dave was awesome. Dave got hurt early in his career and had to become a student coach early. So, you know, in my playing days, it was kind of a little taboo for us to hang out because he was, you know, technically a coach, but we've stayed in touch and been friends ever since. And the Kalu connection
pipeline.
Is the pipeline, if you will, is very strong in college football. No doubt.
So who's the most famous? Who's the most famous Kalu alum or player or what's the pipeline? Where does the pipeline start, Tom?
Probably Dave Aranda would probably be the most famous Kalu alum. You know, he's the coordinator for the national championship LSU Tigers and now the head coach of the Baylor Bears. But we've got coordinators in the NFL. You know, that's probably where a lot of Cal Lutheran's fame is derived from you know, a lot of educators, a lot of teachers, coaches, a lot of high school coaches. So, but no, we've had a lot from the Hagen brothers in the NFL, Corey Unlin. It's hard for me sometimes to remember some of those NFL guys. They change jobs every year, but, we've got our fair share floating around college and NFL. That's for sure.
You had me looking it up. Rod Marinelli as well. Right?
Yeah. Rod Marinelli. Yeah. Certainly. Per capita, one of the strongest showings for any university, that's for sure. My wife and I, we actually dedicated a wall there in their new field house to all the great players and coaches that have come before us, and it's pretty cool. I'll send you I'll have Bianco get a number. I'll send you a picture of that wall. It's pretty neat to see all the coaches and all Americans that have come through Cal Lutheran.
That's really cool for a small school like that to have so many alums that are proud to come back and represent as well. And we started this podcast talking about the health of you personally, but how about the health of your team? It takes a completely different meaning during a time in a pandemic. So last month, over a dozen football players tested positive for the coronavirus. We see it everywhere. Numbers that were really high early on during voluntary workouts throughout the country. How are your players doing right now?
Great. We've got very few players right now that are in quarantine or affected by COVID, and our numbers are way down, trending really, really positively. So, you know, I think, knock on wood, I think the worst is behind us from an individual player on the team's health. Now, obviously, the pandemic is not going anywhere, and the transmission rate and trying to protect families and coaches and people our players come in contact with is still really, really important. But our numbers the last few weeks have been trending in a very, very positive direction.
Coach, how much is playing scientist, you know, playing doctor, how much, you know, I think coaches always talk about people that they lean on for information and to try to lead the way. Like, who have you leaned on or who could you have called in the past that have gone through similar situations or stuff like this, that it's just crazy, unprecedented times. So have you gotten advice and how have you dealt with it yourself?
Well, it's new for everybody, whether your name is Nick Saban or Dabo Sweeney, or, you know, I know Dave called me early in March, we're talking about Dave Aranda, and he said, oh my gosh, what a year to be a first time head coach. And I said, Dave, none of us know, you know, there isn't a manual on this. Nobody's had experience with this. So, we're all kind of, you know, this is uncharted territory for all of us. So I think that the best thing to do is, you know, I've called Kirby at Georgia. I've called Dabo. I've talked to, obviously, the guys in our conference and Lincoln and Gary and those guys, Ryan Day at Ohio State. You know, you try to get a breadth of what different guys across different conferences too are doing because of the way everything is legislated now at a conference level. You're just trying to get an idea, even down to just scheduling, you know, hey, how are you guys handling this return to play model in this period of time that we're in? And then, okay. And then when we start the period where we can walk through on the 24th, you know, what's that going to look like for you guys? And, you know, sometimes even the rules and mandates as sent down from the NCAA in terms of time available to have different activities, those are read differently and interpreted differently by different compliance departments too. So I think it's important as coaches that we talk about, you know, hey, our compliance here is saying we can do this. Is that in alignment with what your compliance people are saying and vice versa? So there's a lot of dialogue, you know, and the cool thing about, you know, coaching right now is, you know, it is a big fraternity, and I think we all want what's best for the game of college football. And so they're guys are eager and willing to talk about anything and everything in relation to their program, because I think we all know that, you know, if we get this, I don't know that there is a right way or a wrong way to handle this, but if we get this done the most right way collectively, then we're going to have the best chance. But if we're all independent contractors in this, then the game suffers probably in the long term.
That's well said too. And it has been a huge issue this offseason without having a leadership at the top, right? When it comes to a commissioner of college football, because we don't have that. And when you go conference to conference, and then you're dealing with, as you mentioned, different legislative rules for state to state, it gets tricky and there's a slippery slope. And with you guys all talking to each other and saying, hey, what works and what doesn't work, that is great. But the biggest challenge will be, as we've seen, you know, a couple of conferences, at least Power Five conferences have talked about just playing, hey, just conference games and limiting that. When you look at the Big 12, and the way this is such a fluid situation, where is your optimism that we will have a season this fall?
Well, I think the optimism is one that we haven't made any decision just yet. I think our leadership, as well as the leadership in other conferences, believe that it is prudent to wait as long as possible before making any concrete schedule affecting decisions. So that gives me confidence that although time is running out, we still do have time, as little as it may be. But I derive confidence from our players. You know, they want to play for the most part. They want to play. They want to find a way, obviously, with the utmost of protection that we can provide them. But they're very eager to find new and different ways to operate. And so I think those are probably the two biggest ways that, at least me personally, that I get confidence in is, one, the players really, really want to play and they're willing to, you know, jump through a lot of hoops in order to get that done. And then, you know, we've still, even though I know it's winding down and every day that passes, we have less of it. But as of today, we still have some time.
You know, the one thing that really stood out there with what you just said was the optimism and also the feedback that you're getting from your players. And I've got to give you guys a lot of credit, college football coaches, throughout the last couple of months on this idea of listening and understanding that, you know, the student athletes there on campus have a voice. And we've seen that play out as well at Texas, you know, after the death of George Floyd. And last month, you know, the student athletes at Texas came together with a "We Are One" statement on Twitter, and they had a list of things that they wanted to see changed. Among that list of changes included renaming certain buildings on campus, replacing statues, starting an outreach program, replacing the eyes of Texas. Now, your interim president, Jay Hartzell, said the university would make a multi-million-dollar investment to the programs that recruit and retain and support Black students. Among the changes that we've seen, a statue there for Julius Whittier, the Longhorns' first Black football letterman, and that's going to be at DKR Texas Memorial Stadium. Another big thing, and something that's really important, or, you know, that carried a lot of weight for you, is the school renaming Joe Jamail Field. Now, the family of Joe Jamail, they suggested this, and it's honoring Texas Heisman Trophy winners Earl Campbell and Ricky Williams. You were there when this happened in the last week. What kind of impact do you think these changes will have on campus?
it's monumental. I mean, I don't have another good adjective for it. You know, I Dar Jamail, Joe Jamail's son, obviously, Joe, who the field had been named after, has been passed away for some years, but his family obviously is still very, very involved. And when Dar Jamail talked to our team about the genesis of this idea, he was very upfront with them in terms of the fact that our players did what they did, gave him the idea to volunteer the giving up of the name of the field. And I mean, how cool is that? That, you know, a bunch of 18 to 22 year old young men and had an issue. They expressed their issue. They did it very respectfully. They did it in as proper of a way as you can. And one of the most iconic stadiums in all of college football now is going to have the name of two black legends attached to it forever that played here. And then maybe more importantly, I don't know if it is or not, but even, you know, they got buildings names changed and fountains and statues built and dedicated. I mean, say what you want about winning and losing football games, and all of us, you know, we all want to win at the highest of levels, but regardless of what any of these young men do in their football playing careers, from this point forward, they're going to be able to walk back to the greatest campus in all of the country and walk around 10 years from now with their wife and their kids and their great job for having gotten a degree at the University of Texas, and walk around and say, hey, son, you see the name on that field? We were part of that. See the name on that building? We were part of that. See the name on that fountain? We were part of that. See that statue that's built? We were part of that. And what an enormous sense of pride as a young man to be able to say that for the rest of your life. You'll be able to say, you know, I was a part of monumental change at one of the premier academic institutions in our country, you know, arguably in the world. And I can't thank them enough and applaud them for how they did it. And what they did is magnificent, in my opinion.
Hey, Coach, let's talk some football. You know, we're heading into the season, and I think you're in a good situation. There's obviously, you know, it's a difficult time, but it's got to be nice to have a quarterback back, all the experience you have back on both sides of the football. So talk about Texas football this year. You probably haven't been able to do a lot of this yet, but talk about what you expect from this team, what you expect from Sam, what your offense is going to look like, and just talk about actually like some football stuff. Let's get weird.
I was going to say, I picked a great time to hire a full-time offensive coordinator, because I know more about COVID-19 mitigation strategies and social injustice than I do about inside zone right now. I can tell you that. I'm excited about the staff changes. You know, Mike Yurcich is certainly a guy that I've had my eye on for years. And then, you know, with Chris Ash on the defensive side, a guy that I've worked with now three different stops, I think he's one of the, if not the best and sharpest defensive minds in college football. So we're excited about that. And I think everybody has a quiet confidence knowing that at the most important position on the field, that we've got a four-year starter returning, and a guy, not just a four-year starter, but a guy that's the leader that he is, and the lightning rod for our team, and knowing his experience level, I think allows everybody to rest easy or at least get through this really difficult period with a lot to look forward to on the other side of it. And, you know, I think when we got here, you know, 3 years ago, we had quite the project ahead of us. And I think internally, you know, most of us had circled 2020 as a year, you know, where, you know, Sam Ehlinger is a fourth year starter, and, you know, we've recruited really well in the classes behind him. And those guys are now third year and second year guys that have been now developed in our program for 2 and 3 years. And you know, the one good thing about being as young and inexperienced as we were last year and having to play as many freshmen and sophomores as we did is that the next year being this year is they're all now, you know, sophomores and juniors, and they had a baptism by fire last year and gained some valuable experience from it. But yeah, having that one guy behind center with the experience that he has, the moxie and the talent, gives us all, I think, in the building a bit of a quiet confidence.
Coach, I know he's a great player. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying, where does he need to go? Where does he need to get better this year to take him to that next stratosphere, to take Texas to the next stratosphere?
You know, he does so many things well. I think, you know, probably for him, one is protecting his body. You know, he plays with such reckless abandon, and you love it about him and appreciate it about him. But I think, you know, him and I have had these conversations where he can be a little bit more judicious on the amount and types of hits that he takes, because we're going to need him to stay completely healthy this year. And then probably from a technical standpoint, I think Sam is always, you know, working on quickening and tightening up his release. And, you know, the RPO game that offensive football is evolving to really requires a guy to get the ball out extremely quickly, from a lot of different arm angles and platforms with their feet and all that. So I think probably the biggest thing fundamentally that he's been working on this offseason has been his off-platform throws, if you will. And then just from a mental side, I think it's you know, all about making sure that his body can withstand, you know, 14, 15 games this year.
Coach, one of the things that you've had to endure and deal with is injuries. Now, you're not the type to make excuses, because every program goes through injuries, but it got to a point where you're looking at the running back position. You're like, good gosh, what's Tom going to do next? Who else is going to convert from what they're doing to now carrying the football? How would you sum up the backfield now, and fully aware of how this is such a unique offseason and what you guys are trying to get through and understand with practices and not having all of spring ball? Where are you right now at the running back position as you head into potential camp?
Well, our two leading rushers are back in Keontae Ingram and Roshan Johnson, a sophomore and freshman last year, with Roshan, you know, obviously very famously having moved from quarterback to running back 2 weeks before the first game, and, you know, winds up rushing for whatever he did, 700, 800 yards and a bunch of touchdowns. You know, he's going to stay at that position and really become a great 1-2 punch with Keontae. And then, you know, to have the nation's number one high school running back in the country coming in as a freshman in Bijan Robinson provides some really, really talented depth at that position. So we feel like we've gone in a year with Roshan's development at that position, as well as the signing of Bijan Robinson and bringing him into our program. We've gone from where that position was probably deemed a area of weakness for our team to an area of strength. And, so I'm really excited to see those guys and what they can do with Roshan and Keontae going into another year at that position, and obviously Bijan coming in fresh out of high school.
Coach, when you look at handling your players now moving forward, like how much different is it going to be for you to trust them physically or to get them in physically? We saw so many videos of guys doing like bicep curls with jugs of water and like lifting groceries, and bro, that ain't going to work. Like that's not football. That's not what they're used to. How do you handle the bodies of the players as opposed to what you normally would in the past?
Yeah, that's a great question. You've got to be really smart. You know, as much, you know, I would say probably 90% of our team did exactly what we asked them to from a strength and conditioning standpoint before they could come back to campus on June 15th. And it wasn't even close to being, you know, in your own weight room, on your own practice field, being trained by your own strength coaches. You know, our conditioning levels were pretty poor. I don't think we're unique in the country based on everybody that I've talked to. And the only way to get it back is time. And so you've got to be urgent. You've got to be very deliberate. You've got to be extremely meticulous with the strength and conditioning program that you want them to adhere to and coach them on. You also have to be cognizant that it's not going to happen overnight. The human body is not built that way. So I think the biggest thing is we've got to be patient. I know it sounds pretty dichotomous, but we've got to be patient but urgent. We've got to be urgent in the fact that our players understand that time is of the essence, and we cannot have a wasted day, a wasted rep, a wasted period while we're out there. But as coaches, we've got to be a bit patient too and cautious, knowing that you know, if we're not careful, then we're going to do more harm than good to their bodies.
So as of right now, you guys are scheduled to open up the season at home on September 5th against South Florida, and then the following week, a road trip to LSU. Of course, we say that as of right now because we're waiting on the decisions on how the Big 12 as well as the SEC will approach conference games as well as out-of-conference games. Let's hope it happens. Let's hope that there's more optimism in the coming weeks. Fingers are crossed, Tom. We do appreciate you joining us here in the College Football Podcast, and we wish you and the entire program the best of health.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me. It's been great to talk a little bit of football, too, and I appreciate everything that you guys are doing. I would be remiss, though, Pollock. I think the last time I talked to you, I was promised a grill. I don't know if you ever delivered on that or not, but I'm still waiting.
I had to wear mine.
You did wear yours. Okay.
I wore mine on TV, bro. I took care of that 100%.
Okay. You wanna... just making sure that it did happen. Okay.
Hey, wait.
100%.
I want to see the picture, Paul. You got a picture? We need proof. You got a picture of you wearing the grill?
I got picture. I got video. It's not the best look I've ever had in my life. I can promise you that.
Oh, it's so good.
And it's great to have college football reporter Heather Dinich back here on the podcast. You've been a consistent call-in for us, so we are so grateful because obviously a fluid situation in the spring into the summer, and it continues. A variety of different stories. Once again, the schedule is the big storyline. Notre Dame AD Jack Swarbrick, he wants to delay the season. He's had a conversation with you, Heather, and he's talking about the concept of reducing games to 8 to 10 this upcoming season. There's a report out there that the Pac-12 looks to be finalizing plans to reduce the schedule to 10 games, all in conference, and starting the season in mid-September, potentially September 19th. Of course, that is something that's out there, not confirmed yet, but being reported that that's in discussions as we tape this podcast. And we're still waiting on the ACC and the SEC next week as they're scheduled to potentially make a decision. Heather, what are you hearing right now? We could start with, you know, the comments from Swarbrick to you personally on what he sees this upcoming season as this stuff changes day to day.
Sure. Notre Dame is an interesting X factor, as always, because of its independence, right? And they lost three huge games when the Big Ten and Pac-12 decided to do what they did, because they lost Wisconsin at Lambeau Field and then obviously USC and Stanford. So right now they're sitting at 9 games. But what the SEC and ACC decide to do are important, because Notre Dame also has a game against Arkansas, and they have 6 games lined up with the ACC. If the ACC goes conference only, what does that mean for Notre Dame? I would expect that it means that it could count towards the ACC conference schedule because there's already contractual agreement between those two. John Swofford, the ACC commissioner, and Jack Swarbrick are friendly, and I would think that they could find some way to come to an agreement with that. Does the ACC announce that next week? And then what exactly is the SEC going to do next week? You know, their commissioner, Greg Sankey, has said multiple times that next week is going to be an important one, but it could also be a big nothing burger. That's the truth of the matter, because this is so fluid. I think everybody continues to monitor the pandemic and those numbers and spikes in certain parts of the country and listen to their medical advisory groups. But everything I have been told from everyone I've talked to, from athletic directors to coaches to commissioners at every level, has said we are going to try as hard as we can to play football this fall in some shape or form.
When you start to hear, you know, Swarbrick, who carries a ton of weight, as you alluded to, when it comes to decision making and not having a commissioner in college football, which will be a theme and a conversation, I think, in every podcast that we have when decisions are made, when they talk about delaying the season and the report from, you know, that we're hearing about the Pac-12, hoping that they could start the season on September 19th. Do you think it's trending this way with the decisions coming from the ACC, the SEC, and other conferences? And let's just be frank, the Power Five outside the Pac-12.
I think it's trending that way, and I say that because one of the reasons, actually the biggest reason to push it back from people that I have talked to, is that they want to see what it's like when the players have helmets and pads on. That doesn't happen until preseason. That doesn't happen until August. And they also want to see what it's like when the general student body returns to campus. 50 to 60,000 students coming back for summer classes, going to the bars, hanging out like they always do. College scene at its best in the summertime, right? What does that do to the testing results of the football players and the staff and the coaching staff and everybody involved in that? You know, Ross Bjork, the Texas A&M athletic director, said, everybody else is going into a bubble, the NBA and Major League Baseball and the WNBA, they're going into a bubble. We're coming out of the bubble and they want to see what that's like in late August. And if you wait until mid-August to make a decision, it would seem likely then that you wait until mid-September to actually start playing football games.
It's a fascinating discussion when you talk about who's in the bubble and who's outside the bubble, because we've seen the success here when it comes to a couple of weeks in with the NBA and, you know, the rates being so dramatically down and no reports of positive tests inside the bubble. And we've seen the numbers being low with Major League Baseball inside their own little bubble. I guess my question is, has anybody discussed the concept of how do we think about potentially playing conference games at a single or a singular destination? For example, I'm just randomly bringing this up. How about the ACC, where they play all their games in Charlotte and all the teams fly there and they play those games, three games a day on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'm just throwing this on the wall, but playing in a place that they feel that it's contained, that they feel like, hey, we're all going to travel anyway, but let's travel to a singular place. Let's just play three games per day, 3 days, and it's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then we go back and we come back again. Has anybody brought up the concept of going to a singular place in each conference?
No, not that I've heard of. And I think part of the reason for that might be because they need the revenue for the games, right? And again, now, of course, that goes back to the question, are fans in stands? And that depends. That's a literally campus by campus decision based on, you know, state and local governments and what's allowed at that point in terms of capacity. But there's also a huge revenue at stake. And I know that there are a lot of schools and commissioners who are under tremendous political pressure in some places to have college football because of the value that it does bring not only to the other sports, obviously, but to those college communities that they're located in. So I haven't heard that, but you know what? If there's one voice and you need a commissioner of college football, you got these ideas. I might cast a vote for you, man.
I'll give these ideas to Mac Brown, because I think if we need a commissioner in football, or maybe Paul Feinbaum, and maybe those two guys could put that out there. But it is a fair point when you talk about local communities that rely on Saturdays, right? And the economy that comes in. And then there's the other side, the scary proposition. And it is scary when you have venues that are at 100,000 that can see, and they're saying, we'll go 50%. That's still 50,000. 50,000 fans in a general area. And you can make a requirement with masks, but you cannot police literally everybody in every single moment inside a stadium and what they're going to do. And that's where it gets compromised. And like you said at the start of this discussion, they are now going outside the bubble to start a season, because you're on campuses with thousands of kids that go in and out, and that are going to live the way that they want to live. And they're going to interact with multiple people outside of just, you know, their dorm room or their apartment, and that could get compromised. Now, another thing, with all the stuff that we're reporting on and discussing, there's something, as we're taping this Thursday, there's something to circle for tomorrow, Friday, a scheduled Board of Governors meeting with the NCAA. What should we keep an eye on here, Heather? What are you hearing?
So the concern from commissioners and athletic directors that I've spoken to is that the NCAA Board of Governors, which is comprised mainly of university presidents and chancellors that represent all levels of athletics, is the possibility that they would consider eliminating conference championships for fall sports. And this is a conversation that has started maybe a week or so ago and has a lot of people very concerned, so much so that the Football Oversight Committee Chair Shane Lyons, who's also the West Virginia Athletic Director, sent a letter to the NCAA Board of Governors saying essentially a plea to have some patience with making a decision like this. And I was told that the Collegiate Commissioners Association, which is comprised of 32 conferences, 27 of them supported a letter similarly voicing extreme concern about the possibility of that. Now, remember, the NCAA does not control the football championships unless it's the FCS level. We're talking about NCAA-sponsored championships, volleyball, men's and women's soccer. And the issue there is, what happens if they do that? What kind of a trickle-down effect does that have? And the elephant in the room is, it's basically a precursor to canceling fall sports, because you have all these athletes with nothing to play for if they make that decision, right? And there was just a lot of people I talked to who said, now hold on, now wait. Now, again, we go back to your first question about the SEC and the ACC, what they might say, what they might do next week, what the timetable is, will the season start on time? So the Board of Governors has another meeting on August 4th. And it's also possible that the Power Five commissioners, particularly the SEC, ACC, and Big 12, wait until after that meeting to see what they do before making any other major decisions. Because if they cancel fall sports championships, and again, that would include the FCS football championship, that would have, what Big 12 commissioner Bob Bowlesby told me, a profound effect on everything else.
Wow. So this is obviously fluid. And every time we talk, it feels like that window of optimism gets smaller and smaller. When you talk to coaches, do you feel that same vibe? When you talk to administrative officials, do you feel that same vibe?
So there's a different vibe between coaches and officials. It's very clear. I talked to Brian Kelly at Notre Dame today. I talked to Mike Leach yesterday. And, you know, they say repeatedly, we're going to continue to do what we can until somebody tells us stop, basically, with the health and safety of their athletes in mind. I mean, you know, Brian Kelly's got electronic whistles ready to go. He told me that they've got plastic fitted mouth face masks that you can, so that the players can actually read their lips and see their facial expressions as they coach. And they're going to be mic'd up as these walkthroughs start next week. So, you know, they're doing what they are permitted to do within the realm of the guidelines of the NCAA Medical Advisory Committee and their own universities, obviously. But I have been told so many times, these kids want to play. They get it. They see what happens when you test positive and the ramifications that it has when you're not following social distancing measures. But again, that's because they're in their bubble, right? The guidelines and the facilities, they're better than any gym, any high school gym, what we all have, right?
Yeah.
They're taken care of to the T right now. But once you add that student body in the mix, that's when everybody starts to get a little bit nervous about, okay, can they still be disciplined? I mean, you talk about competitive advantages. I think discipline might be the biggest one this season.
If we have potentially a season that starts, let's just say September 19th, like the Pac-12 reportedly is thinking about, and these Power Five conferences fall in line and the Group of Five decide that they're going to wait as well, because those first couple of weeks, for the majority, not for everyone, but for the majority, you have out of conference games. And we have this window where we see teams play 7 to 8 games. What would that do? And again, we're playing a game of hypothetical with every scenario we're talking about. What would that do when it comes to the concept of a playoff conversation?
So CFP Executive Director Bill Hancock has stayed away from hypotheticals in our conversations as much as he possibly can. And he has repeatedly told me that whatever happens, whatever scenario it might be, he said the CFP will be ready for whatever comes down. And I've talked to the executive director of the Football Bowl Association, who has said, even if college football is bumped to the spring, we plan on having our bowl games as normal. So as far as the postseason goes, the people who are in charge of that have said status quo to this point. Now, again, as you mentioned repeatedly, it's fluid. Who knows,
yes,
you know, if you get to March, what that might look like. But that's what I'm being told today. Now, here's the other thing, is that it's always an uneven playing field with a college football playoff. Some leagues play 8, some leagues play 9 conference game. The divisions are lopsided, whatever it might be, right? So this year, I mean, it's quite possible that somebody plays 10 games and somebody plays 8, like total, you know? So that's what Hancock told me. That's what the selection committee's job is to do, is to determine the 4 best teams based on the schedules the conferences come up with, right? So will it be more difficult than in years past? Absolutely. But it will also still be uneven, and you better believe whoever wins it will probably have an asterisk by their name this year.
Yeah, which is a shame too. And I say a shame because, you know, if you can win a championship under these conditions in 2020 in any sport, it says a lot about perseverance. And also it could be the luck of the draw on how well you follow safety protocols, right? And that's the challenge. If we are debating, let's just say this, if we are on a podcast and we're debating potentially in October or November which team deserves to get into a playoff, I will welcome that type of conversation here, because I just want to see football. I think all of us share that, but also at a point where people are protected and safe. And with that, the final question here in this hypothetical scenario, where is the buildup in conversation? And not from the coaches, because the coaches are blinders on, I'm thinking about the fall. But when you're talking to officials and commissioners, where is the conversation on the idea of playing spring football right now?
Right now, it still remains completely on the back burner. And that's because they're so focused on trying to figure out and exhaust just about every option to play in the fall. Now, it was interesting this past week when the SWAC announced that it had actual tangible plans on paper for a spring season, because we hadn't seen that really put out publicly, right? People have said, well, we might postpone it to the spring, but we'll see what the virus is like at that point. But I asked Charles McClellan, you know, other commissioners have told me the reason, a big reason they haven't said, well, let's just scrap the fall and move it to the spring, is because nobody has any idea if it will be any better at that point than it is now. Why did you decide to lay this out? And his main reason was to give the athletes and the coaches and the fans hope that there might be something coming down the line. But at the same time, if the coronavirus pandemic is the exact same, then there won't be a spring. But of course, you have all the other challenges, like the NFL draft, and what happens if it's going up against March Madness at that point, and of course, coinciding with your typical flu season. There are just so many other variables that make it extremely challenging. But Jack Swarbrick, again, Notre Dame's athletic director, told me, and I think this sums up the consensus, which is we have to be prepared to do it. It has to be considered a viable option in case it is the only option, basically. And Bob Bowlesby in the Big 12 has said it's not a first choice and it's not a second choice. So I think it's, some people have said it's a last choice. That's what Sandy Barber at Penn State said, but other people are hesitant to go that far, but it's certainly not at the top of the priority list.
We'll put in this category, in case of emergency, break glass. That's when you do it. And like, in case of a, like, you walk by, you're fully aware it's right there, but you never really look at it. And when you have no choice, okay, we got to break glass here because there's an emergency. Yep. We've got to figure this out on saving the season. We'll see how that plays out. Let's hope we don't have to break the glass there. Heather, thank you. Things will be changing. I'm sure tomorrow and developing coming off that Board of Governors NCAA meeting, but such good info. And we hope we can talk to you soon with more positive news as this continues to be a fluid situation entering August.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And if I could just mention just one more thing, because I know a lot of people get confused about the decision-making process and there are so many things. I just want to remind anybody who's listening to this that there's an order to this, right? And the first is the coronavirus pandemic in terms of how these decisions are going to be made. And the second is the medical experts and the scientists who are advising these conferences. Every single conference has a medical advisory board. And then you've also got the university presidents, again, on the Board of Governors, right? They're so important because if there are no students on campus, there's no sports. It's that simple. And then the Power Five commissioners, and then the athletic directors, and then, I mean, the coaches, they're basically giving input to the athletic directors. So there's a long line of people involved in this decision-making process, and it is just far from over. Anybody who tells you they know exactly what's going to happen is full you-know-what.
And you know what? You laying this out for us is a great reminder, and it's absolutely the perfect context and nuance we need to understand. And also bring it up often, because we go straight to the source on SportsCenter because we've got like literally 2 minutes. Let's get the interview done, in and out. What have you heard? But you're right. When you could lay it out and understand that there are so many levels to this, before we get an answer, and to understand that safety first, dealing with the coronavirus, as we are still in this pandemic, and in many states, the numbers continue to rise at an alarming rate. So, Heather, thank you so much. Stay safe and healthy.
Thank you. You too.
Good stuff there from Heather Dinich. Every single time that she's on, I learn something new, and I'm really happy that she explained some nuance and context that these guys that are, you know, always at the forefront when it comes to quotes, the ADs and the conference commissioners, they are all following the lead of medical advisors. And that's the priority for everyone involved. Big thank you to Tom Herman, Texas head coach, with his thoughts about what's going on in Austin, as well as the future of the program. And of course, our fantastic producer, Taylor Schwenk, who does a great job week in and week out for us to make sure we can bring you this podcast. I want everybody to stay safe and healthy. If you want football in the fall, wear a mask and social distance while you enjoy the summer. We'll talk to you soon.